there is such an understanding, that is the first mistake. That there is something in heavens besides God that is independently powerful, that is something that has an existence in its own right, is wrong. And sometime later when he does speak about angels, we'll speak more about what they are and why they are. But the first thing is, as vis-a-vis God's existence, they are non-existent. They have no independent existence. They are creations as much as we are. They did not make themselves. They do not exist forever. They came into being. They might be more spiritual than us. They might be of longer lasting nature than us. But still, they are beings that came into existence from point A, and that's it. So the first thing the Rambam is trying to eliminate is that any type of higher spiritual beings, as it may be, does not have its right for own existence the way God does. One. Two, those things that he says on earth, meaning since it was considered by many thinkers that the earth is of such crass and coarse material that it cannot be that God created it. One of the big riddles that philosophers presented, and especially the Greek philosophers who made God into an extraordinary intellectual being, could not find a common denominator of a physical world with a spiritual God. So the real world might be God and spirit and everything. Anything that's physical and creative cannot be from God. It must have its own existence, and God overwhelms it with his existence. So the second mistake was the earth, as physical and as crass as it is, and as ungodlike as it is, it still came from God's existence. He gave it his. How? It is one of the things that's very difficult to understand. How, from a pure godliness, did something as physical and coarse come in? But it's there. That is the second point that he means an earth. Third, and in between. What is in between? In between, he means as follows. Definitely, the heavens are spiritual beings, but they've got no surprises. Angels do what angels do, and except for two or three or four places where the Talmud mentions angels sort of going on strike or messing up, we're not used to angels messing up. Angels do exactly as they're told. So the thing that strikes us about angels is that they are very mechanical, and it's clear to us that they don't have their own existence. They're just machinery for God to bring his will into the world. One. The other hand, the physical world is governed by real laws that determine how things are, and that also makes sense to us that it's preset by somebody, and you know, and someone brought them into existence, created those laws that govern their being, and that's that. There is one point, that fluctuation in the world, which is human being and free will. Human being is in the middle, in the sense that it's like when you have something on a fulcrum, and the thing can go either way, any way, whichever way. In other words, human free will is not only extraordinary gift, but more than that, it seems to be spontaneous and not predetermined. People are familiar, one of the issues about artificial intelligence is whether or not you can have a machine that mimics a human being. One of the so-called thought experiments with a machine is the following. If you get one of these calls from a computer-generated advertising agency, how can you tell whether it's a computer or a person? And assuming the voice chips are sophisticated. So the first thing is when they're trying to sell something, you assume one of that it's a computer. Fine. But let's say you have a very sophisticated voice chip, and it gives and it calls off and carries on a lovely conversation with you. Can you tell in any way that it's a machine versus a human being?
Yeah.
What?
Definitely.
How?
if someone calls you up and
listens to you, you know it's a person.
And you say,
no.
And you say, I can't speak with you now. We just had, God forbid, a death in the family.
Yeah.
You could tell right away.
You could even, if the software was sophisticated enough, you could have a recognition system with common things. I can't talk right now. We would say, we will call back later.
Right.
Okay, fine.
Do it, but it can't take into account every possibility.
Okay, so let's go one step
further.
Fine,
sure.
Fine. But let's maybe just conceptualize the job more. A computer software is always a program. The word spontaneous cannot apply to computer software unless there's a glitch. But if there's no glitch, it's going to follow a pattern no matter what. And one of the actual most difficult things they had with computers was generating random numbers with a computer is one of the most difficult tasks. Because you can't make a program to generate a random number. What you do is, by definition, it's not going to be random.
Right.
What they do is, they take some phenomena, for instance, they'll take a certain amount of, to measure white noise level in the background, and you know count that and divide it or square it or something. They'll always have to pick some phenomena that's existing and work with that. That's the reality of a number. Where, as a human being, we feel it's spontaneous. And there are people that have made the argument that we're also programmed and we're predetermined, and in that case, I've got no argument. But our definite sensation is that a human being is coming from himself. I'm not a machine is doing what's been programmed to do. A person is doing something that's almost spontaneous from himself. So the third and most difficult alternative to God, it would be a human being self-created. God might physically put him in, but my personality, that I can originate ideas and I'm not bound by anything that pushed me before, allows a person a real possibility of thinking that he is existent independent of God. So the first things we have to understand, God as the primary being, and v'chol ha'nimtza'im in shamayim v'aretz, and anything that is found in heavens and earth, which we explained means angels, spiritual beings, and physical material, u'ma b'nehem, and that which is between them, which we explained to be man, I think, l'nimtzo elam amitas imatzav, have existence only by virtue of God's existence. There is a phrase in the Midrash that lends itself to the explanation I gave to you. We explained when we started the book that this is most of the Rambam's works can be very clearly traced to Gemara. Not only can they, but they have to be, because they are a summation of the different points of the Gemara put together. This particular Sefer is difficult, because he's dealing with Haggadah material. He takes material in the Gemara and then recasts it in words that he's expressing himself. It's a lot more difficult to find the source for these points. And some of them are just his understanding. One of the sources that is listed by later commentaries, obviously, as a possible source for this is a Midrash in Devarim. And it reads the following. Ein od milvado. There's a pasuk in Devarim. There is no one but God. So the Midrash says, afilu b'chalalo shel olam. Even in the hollow of the world. Chalalo shel olam is a metaphor meaning in the bubble, in the empty bubble of the world. Which, not clear yet what that means. Actually, the word chalal in modern Hebrew means space, or vacuum, hollow, it's the same meaning, basically. It means the entire Hollywood. What are they referring to? There is no one but him. You know, the pasuk says, "Vashamayim imal u'ma'aretz etochatz," both in heavens above and the earth down. Ein od milvado, there's no one but him. Afilu bechalalo shalolom, even the hollow of the world. Very, very hard to understand what that means. What does it mean, the hollow of the world? There's a Gemara uses a similar expression. A very strange Gemara. The Gemara says, were all the pens, were all the trees pens and all the lakes ink, and all the seas inks, we could not write out everything in halalo shel roshus. Halalo meaning empty, halo. Roshus means government, human government. Reishin vav tav, like reshut in modern Hebrew, meaning the Palestinian Authority is called reshut ha-Palestinai. The reshut is not reshut, but reshut. That's probably maybe more appropriate for that, but reshut meaning the authority, the scope, authority. Reshut ha-Yachid means private domain. Reshut ha-Rabim is public domain. The word reshut means, so it says, even if you had all the pens, you could not write out everything in the halalo shel reshut. So Rashi says it's referring to the government, which is Rome, you know, which was the most encompassing government. And Rashi says there are so much going on at one time, wars and taxes and the economy and so on, it would be impossible for a human being to possibly write it all out. It's a very strange Gemara, because yes, Rome was a strong empire, a mighty empire, but we're not given to flowery veneration of Roman Empire. Like, you know, wow, if you'd have all the pens and all that and so on, it's a strange, very, very strange Gemara. One of the explanations given, with sort of a touch of Kabbalah, I guess, on it is, the word hollow, halal meaning emptiness, hollowness, refers to the domain where God does not interfere. In other words, the area of human free will is called hollow domain in the sense God chooses not to interfere except for very rare cases. And it's the entire encompassment of human ability. Ability in the sense, ability to act. So halalo shel rashut would mean human activity is inherently limitless. It's inherently not given to setting down in stone and writing it down because free will is so under. So taking that concept of halalo shel rashut and saying that the word halal over here, that the Midrash means the same thing used the word halal, would lead us to the explanation I gave in the Rambam. Halal shel rashut means predetermined or mechanized activity, but it's where there's freedom to do, there's emptiness, and that becomes human domain, and that's what the Rambam is referring to. It's a guess, it's very tantalizing, that's where it's leading to. And I feel it is true, but it's not 100%. Yes.
But he's saying
I feel, yeah.
So even in the places
where one would think right,
that we have
right,
still it can't exist without Hashem.
Right, exactly. Right, but that's like the third point of Chiddush. Okay, so we finished the first halacha. Let's go turn over the page and we have the second halacha. The imyale al hadas. No, it's on the same page. Let's go slide. The imyale al hadas. And if it were possible to imagine shehu einay matzui, that he is not, that God does not exist, ein davar achol yochol imatzos, nothing else could exist. Meaning, as opposed to anything that we're aware of, and that's, for instance, let's say a person makes a table and then passes away, the table remains. There's no reason, the fact that the person made the table, a person thinks of a tremendous invention, an idea, and the person dies, the idea, if it was published, remains, and so on. Everything that he did remains. A person is thinking of something, he has an idea, a thought, a fantasy, and he dies, there is no thought, there is no fantasy, there is no idea, because the idea was existed only as a bubble within the person's existence. So if God were not to exist, then nothing else could exist, because nothing else has the ability to remain in existence. And that's why we say every day in davening, we say, Amechadesh b'chol yom b'tuvo, la'otzar, thus God is constantly giving existence to the world because the world has no intrinsic existence. I think last time we gave a sort of an illustration, a different area. If let's say I help somebody get a job, I have a firm, and I help somebody become the accountant. There are 1,000 applicants, and this guy might not have been the most capable one, but I pushed him in, he's hired as the accountant, and he does a lot of work, and he gets paid, and 5 years later, if I leave, he still has a job. Possibly the guy might fire him, but he is an accountant in a firm. He's, even though I had to push him in, but his validity is, I am an accountant, I am doing the books of the place, and if you want to get rid of me, then you have to fire me. On the other hand, let's say I have a large company, and I have a favorite nephew who's really quite incompetent. For whatever reason, he is my favorite nephew, but he can't and to count the tiles, you know, or whatever it is, just to read through the daily newspaper every day, and he gets paid for it. That his job is only as long as I want it, because he doesn't really have a job. There is no, in that company, there is no job of counting the tiles or reading the papers. It's just my desire for him. And the minute I either decide I don't want, or someone else, I sell the company. The day I sell the company, you don't have to fire him. He doesn't really have a job, because there is no job like that in the company. It's one of the things, going off a little bit on a tangent, just understanding the attitude towards God on a personal level. Somebody once in yeshiva asked me, there was a boy in yeshiva, a boy from a very successful family, well too, and everything, and him, age of 19, passed away, just didn't wake up one morning. Right. Terrible tragedy, a few years ago. And he came to me very distraught and he said, like, why did God do it, or how could God do it? It wasn't a major crisis, but it's something that he was trying to grapple with. And I asked him, you're looking at it wrong. The question is, why did you wake up this morning? We granted, our innermost feeling is, we're living, we exist, we deserve to exist, and God has to kill us in order to get rid of us. That's not true. God has to wake us up in the morning in order that we continue to live. It's the other way around. We don't have our own quote-unquote right to exist or existence. We only exist because God chooses. There's got to be a choice that we exist every minute, and not vice versa. I once saw a very cute, like sort of also, I guess, an illustration of sorts. This was an argument between the boys to Chabad to study. Usually the hero, whoever's telling the story, it puts himself as the hero, but it does fit. I read it, and they, in Chabad, they do spend a lot more time learning about different things, this type of things, than other Hasidim do. So, I mean, that's the setup of the story. So, he came back after a while and asked him, what did you learn? Give me an example of something you learned. So he told him, let's assume that God would have this world. How would he do it? He said, he would drown the marble. So he said, well, a flood leaves over plenty of wreckage. You get a lot of muck left over if the flood recedes. That's not other stuff. So you'd burn it. So he said, well, the ashes, the gases, there's something left over. So he said, okay, wise guy, how would he do it? So he said, he simply would not want it. In other words, the attitude that you have to destroy something, it's like, how do you stop dreaming? What do you do to a dream to stop it? You just don't dream. You don't need to go and to do something to it. If our existence is an existence within God's existence, then our existence is, our continuous existence is dependent on something. One more illustration, because I think these points sound very abstract when they're on paper here, but they come in, like, in a lot of situations where you just don't realize it. I used to be for many years at Eishet Torah. I used to teach in Jerusalem. And you do get to meet a lot of interesting people. It's one of the benefits. You know, a lot of good stories, because you always meet very, very nice people and very interesting people. And one day I was sitting with a boy who had been studying in JTS, which is a conservative seminary. Very fine boy, very intelligent, very nice. We really liked him. And we were talking. He had learned a little bit Gemara and was fascinated by how the rabbis could determine certain halachic points and so on. And he said, in a very positive way, not in any sense negative, it shows you the fact that the court here decides what halacha is, and that really becomes God's word, so to speak, how much God respects human intelligence. And he meant it very positive. It wasn't anything. I told him, Let me tell you where you're making a mistake. Let's say I was having a dialogue with Einstein. So Einstein is so much more smart than I am, and the chances that I can enlighten him at any one point is negligible. Fine. But it's not impossible. There would not be anything impossible by saying, you know, I spoke to Einstein and I told him something he never thought of before. Or I asked a question about something, and you know, if I do it too many times, the laws of probability would stack up against me. But if I said I once had this conversation, I asked him, he couldn't answer me, or I showed him something, he said it's brilliant, it would not be impossible. And anyway, and actually in science, it always happens. You know, no matter how brilliant somebody is, there'll always be somebody that'll point out something which, you know, somebody who's much less smart. That's not a problem. Let's say I had a puppet show. And, you know, I was running puppets and I was a ventriloquist and they were talking. Would it make sense to come and say, you know, today he really did laugh? I mean, that would be ludicrous. It's only me, you know, the puppet is me talking through it. So there's a difference between huge versus tiny, which, let's say, it's the same thing if I was fighting somebody extremely strong. I could still land the punch, I could still hurt him, probability is that I would end up being creamed, but it's not an impossibility. As I told him, your mistake is your view of God is as being a super person and a human being as being a tiny person. But the idea that existence versus existing by means automatically that it can't be better. A computer program can be faster than the one that made it, but it can't be smarter. The computer program cannot be smarter. It can be incrementally smarter. It can do 1,000 equations, but the basic idea, it can't have a basic idea that the programmer didn't have. It's only just piling up ideas, but not. It's the same thing in this. The corollary of this point that if we could imagine God would not exist, nothing else would exist, is the point that we've made now. That anything in the world not only can't supersede God, but doesn't have any place within, not our intelligence, not our might, nothing of ours stands up to God. It doesn't equal God's or is overshadowed. It just, when put face to face to God, it's like the idea to the person, it's like the puppet to the puppeteer, and so on. V'im, Gimel, and three, it's actually one halacha, I guess. V'im yale al hadas, and were we to imagine she'ein kol ha'nitzroyim melvado mitzuyim, that nothing else but God would exist, hu levado yeh matzui, he himself would exist, v'lo yibotel hu lebitulam, and he would not cease to exist if they would exist. And let me explain this also. This is based probably on a midrash. Many later commentators have annotated as being the source. And it says the following. It's in last week's Sedra. It says, Vayifka b'makom, Yaakov reached the place. So the midrash says, Melamed she'akadosh baruch hu mekomo shel olam, God is the place of the world. The ein ha'olam mekomo, and the world is not the place of God. A similar expression is used in a midrash that Akharish Baruch was me'ono shel olam. It is the house of the world, or the residence, or the domicile of the world. The ein olam me'ono. What does it mean that God is the place of world? The world is not the place of God. Well, what do we mean by that? So let's try to understand it. Let's take a world that we have, a world with physical manifestations and laws that govern it. For instance, all items that have mass show examples of the laws of gravity, of the law of gravity. So in a certain sense, the law of gravity is an overriding factor, and the details are examples of it. But on the other hand, a world that would not have anything with mass, the law of gravity would not exist. The law is, in a sense, the common phenomena of all things that exhibit its property. So when you have details and examples that manifest a certain law, so the law is the common denominator of the interaction of all objects with mass. If you don't have objects with mass, the law of gravity would not exist. The law is simply a description that fits the central axis of the phenomena of all things that fall or attract each other and so on. If you would not have the law of electricity, of electromagnetism, would not exist in a world where you don't have positive and negative particles that interact in a certain way. Even things that override other things. Let's take another example. The laws, in a more loose word, of human behavior, of human psychology, would not exist in a zoo. The human psychology is only when you have human beings that manifest that behavior. I'm sure some of you would think it's a philosophical point, you know, where you don't have the details of the rule exist or not, but for better or for worse, it's a fair statement to say that when you don't have the details, then the overriding rule becomes obsolete or non-existent or academic at worst. But that's it. The way in which one of the mistakes of understanding God is, it's the sum total of human hope, human expectation, human knowledge. Somewhere along the line, it is. God is a product of human reaching up to something. Was there nothing in the world, then God becomes a meaningless entity. It's not determined by the ruler of all, the king of the... When I say the king of the world, when there is no more world, then you lost your job. You become unemployed. When the last soldier in the country dies, then the king becomes no king. So when we refer to God as king of the world, then we say... when there's no world, there's no king. So God is dependent on us. If I call God the creator, so if he never created anything, then he doesn't exist. In any way that I define God in relationship to us, I'm automatically providing a way for him to be obsolete. Creator means he created. Get rid of the creations, make believe there never was creations, had there not been creations. So one might say God needed to create the world for himself to exist, chas v'shalom. Or, just one second, or God is king because there are people to rule over, and if there's no one around, then he can't rule. So the Rambam is saying no. And that's what the Midrash is saying. He is the place within which the world exists, but the world is not the backdrop for his existence. Yes, what did you want?
No, I was just going to ask you, can't he create and then have a requirement that he continuously create? Or the creation go away?
A requirement in what sense?
That he has to continuously do something. Like he makes a tree or a piece of grass, and every second has to be continuously
correct.
Creating that
correct.
Piece of grass.
Correct.
And if he stops something, it's just the fact that he made it.
Correct. Now the question, what do you mean? Are you referring back to which point?
Just to the last point where you were saying... The fact is, if he created something,
yeah.
Then by definition, not by definition, but you said that could mean that you don't need God anymore.
That would be true
creator,
in our
right.
If creating was something akin to our activities of building or doing, that would be true.
Right.
Creating distinguishes itself that it's from our act of doing or making, because you can't walk away from it and it remain in existence.
It's also from nothing.
Yeah, but it's also from nothing. But that's always, just like if I'm thinking of something, I'm fantasizing something. So it's only, since it doesn't have its own reality, it's dependent on me all the time. Yes?
Yeah, I wonder, it sounds like... even though the Rambam isn't writing with like a bazaar of Kabbalah
yeah.
in his writing, but it sounds very much as though he's alluding to the same distinction that the Kabbalim make in Ein Sof And the Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, also Elohim, they make a difference between God existing,
right?
God existing and God bringing himself into this, as it were, Kaviyahol, bringing a relationship with this creation that comes through this, the Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei.
Okay, let me refer back to the point you're making. I mean, she's referring to the fact that the Rambam does not have the Mesoros of Kabbalah, did not have the Vetra knowledge, and yet the ideas are set up similar. You're a doctor, and let's say you are describing to a very lay audience and the human body. So you wouldn't use any fancy terminology, and you're talking about the stomach, you would explain about how it goes down a pipe, and it stops, and then it goes down, and then it gets ground up, and you would have a whole discourse of that. Somebody who's a little bright could probably extract an outline of it and so on. Then, if you go to a medical textbook, you would get that information in words, and you'd have very clear terminology, and somebody would say, my gosh, it's the same thing. It is. The difference, it's the basic tenets of belief are the same. And that distinction between God, first, Ein Sof, as you want to say, Sof, all those terms, and God, the way he applies those things, those ideas are very basic, and they must go, however system you're going to use is going to have to come out. Because that's very basic to the Mekubalim, what they did was, they had the advantage of a very technical Mesoros where they could use very precise terminology. And the advantage of using precise terminology is that you can build much quicker. It's just like if you'd have to write a textbook on medicine using kitchen terminology, the big hole and that funny bone and this and that, you couldn't go too far with it because when you have very crisp terminology, so first thing is you confuse the layman, that's one advantage, and the second advantage is that you can really, you can build a lot out further. The Kabbalah was able to ramify because it had a very strong source. But the basic ideas, certainly at this level, have to be very much the same. Yes, correct. So he says, okay, and so let me just go back to finish off this idea about place, because it's a very important idea. The word place means what you call in logic a universal set. It's within what framework? When I say there are three different types, so the first question is, what are the parameters that we're talking about? What when I say there's blood types A, B, and AB, and O, blood types in what? What is the topic we're talking about? So we're talking about a certain set of reactions. Fine. So now I've defined background, I've defined the general set, and then I say within that set, we have four divisions. But the words place, as used in a more philosophical sense and when dealing with these topics, is just like the place is wherein you build. Everything has to exist within the place. So when I say that this person is an excellent accountant, within what? With America, the world, taxes, give me the parameters that describe the entire set that you're talking about. And then we can put him in a niche. So when we say that God is the place of the world, means the world exists only in the context of God. God wanted a certain world. Fine. Within that context of God, there is the subdivision of human beings and so on. On the other hand, the world is not the context for God. It's not all of what the ultimate creator, the great designer. God is a great designer, and he is the great designer of the world, but he is not the great designer. He, because that limits him to the world. If you take the building away, there's no great designer. He is the creator, but he's not the creator. That's not him. It's within the world, his role is the creator. But I don't limit God and say, well, what's God? So I say, well, look around the whole world. He's the creator of the world. No, one of his activities was creating the world. And that's a very big distinction. It means we take God out of our context, and we give him his own context. So let's just finish off this halacha so we get that. And was the entire, if it were possible to imagine that nothing else but God existed, who levadu yematzi, he will exist, v'lo yibotel hu lebitulam, and he would not become in any way cancelled out because of their cancelled existence. Shekol hanimtzoyim tzrichen loy, because everything that exists needs him, v'hu baruch hu, v'rakadosh baruch hu eino tzorech lahem, does not need them, v'lo le'echad mehem, nor even one of them. In other words, it does not need any element to this world to give him existence. There's one more point that the Rambam is sort of trying to avoid, I would say, not avoid, but that he's trying to cancel out a certain idea. One of the questions that we wrestled with was, why did God create the world? And that question has a lot of answers, peddled, you know, wide and far. He created the world for his glory, for to benefit humanity, to do good, and so on and so forth. They're all true. But they're all true in with a subtle distinction of what does it mean, why God created the world. If the question is, if I ask why somebody did something, and I explain it in terms of the fact that this person was plotting something, and A leads to B, so that is a correct expression of why God created the world. Towards what purpose was the world created? To bring out his glory, to benefit humanity, and so on and so forth. All those reasons answer that question. So it's answer question. But there's another way of asking why. A psychologist puts somebody on a couch and says, what's driving this person to be a nuisance? Or what's driving this person to do this or that? What I'm really looking for is, what lack does that person have in his personality that he needs something else? Why is this person so desperate for money? Because he grew up poor and he needs the comp security. Or he suffered from a lack of recognition, this gives him recognition. Or whatever it is that a psychologist comes up with. So what I'm really, so anytime I say why does somebody need something, what I'm explaining is that this person has a hole in his personality and something's got to fill it up. This person needs love, so he showers gifts on everybody and hopes to get to be reciprocated. Or this person needs honors, and that's why he goes around bragging, or whatever it is. That question about God, obviously does not, we cannot answer that question in that context because it just doesn't apply. So if we to ask why did God create a world, any answer that sort of even has an inkling of pointing towards some lack that God needed a world to fulfill a need is basically kfira, because basically you're creating, God is imperfect and he needs the world to perfect it. So the that idea can't be. That's another point, I think, that the Rambam is trying to say, that God does not need any part of the world, meaning even though he created it and there are reasons for the creation, but none of those reasons can point to a lack. In other words, God needs people so that he must do kindness, so he needs people to be part of his kindness. No, because then what you're basically doing is translating it into a lack in God. So therefore, were anything in the world to be lacking, not only would God remain in existence, but he would not be lacking anything. Nothing in God would become buttle, would become missing, would be missing. If the entire world were to disappear, then it would not affect God. Because we're a product of God and not the other way around. Yes?
Well, I think, trying to my mind, that's like the dream analogy is perfect. Like George Bush has a dream, for instance.
Right.
And I exist in George's dream, and he wakes up, his life is no difference with or without me.
Right. Yeah. Right. Same thing. Same thing. In other words, it can't be that is something which is if B is a creation of A, that means A's existence was not lacking for anything. You can't. Unfortunately, people who are ill, people who are mentally ill. One of the things is they need their dreams so badly that they sort of it becomes reality to them, and vice versa. Fine. That's a sickness, an aberration. Yes.
How did you deal with the concept that?
Okay, so basically, as far as the Rambam goes, we're holding here. In other words, this is at the end of Gimel. Yes, what did you want, John?
That Hashem wants us to do good, or wants us to do mitzvahs, or wants us to learn Torah. Does that contradict this? I mean, if none of this really matters, make the difference to him.
Okay, so let me try to... So let's give a relationship that we could see the same thing. If a person wants his wife to cook dinner, that's because he wants dinner. So, you know, there's a need. He comes home hungry, and his wife is going to cook dinner, and it's a real need situation. Let's take a look with a kid, where it's a lot more subtle. A kid comes home, and he does well in school. child to say, you know, I brought home the test, I got 100. It's if the kid paints the house, so the father needed the house painted, and if the kid paints it, wonderful, my father, I did it for him. But if the child succeeds on his own, then it's more true to say the following way. The child, the father wants the child to do well, to be matzliach, to do well, and so on and so forth. He's got, the context of their relationship as parent and child is that the relationship intensifies when things go well. So it's not that there's a particular need for this as such, but there's a context of a father-child relationship, which is the child doing a nachas ruach and so on. God set up a relationship. And within that context of that relationship, mitzvahs enhance it tremendously, averis detract from it. So, yes, when we do mitzvahs, they count because they can. I mean, if a kid comes home, he'll come home with a 40 on an algebra test, and I'll say, Dad, you can care less about algebra either. So, what's it to you? You know, you don't need algebra now. Like, what's it to you if I knew the answer, didn't know the answer? Well, you're right. It's nothing to me if you knew how to do the problem, but you're succeeding or not succeeding is the point of relationship. So God created a context of relationship of good and bad, right and wrong, which translate to closeness or disparity. And within the context, it's important.
So the question is about the context, not so much.
Exactly. We can only deal, one of the things, there's a lesson in the Mishnah. There is, the Mishnah says in Chagiga something. Chagiga is the only place where the Gemara really speaks on Kabbalah type topics, very veiled, but there is. And the Mishnah says you cannot ask about what was on top, on the bottom, behind, or in the front. Basically, what it means is there is a set framework that of context that we allow to, that we are able to think about, research, get involved. Anything past that, so like you said, in the context of the relationship, in that fullness of that context, everything is valid. All questions. Past that, the human mind stops. There is no validity. Yeah.
Well, you brought up a third point. I think in Nitzavim.
Yeah.
It says that, you know, the secret things are.
Right. And Hanistoros Hashem Elokeinu. Right. I don't even know if that's referring to. Because anything that's past that, the context of the relationship, is past the context. But.
But when the Torah says Nistarim, in that.
It's possibly. Yes, by the way.
I was going to say that when a child treats a parent with respect,
yeah,
which is a relationship thing, because if gaining an A on a test is not relationship. When a child treats a parent with respect, in fact, if the adult is whole,
yeah,
and well, then she or he does not require the child's respect. For your own sense of yourself. Fortunately, it would happen.
Well, but there is a difference. See,
no, I'm just saying that's a little bit farther. It seems like that's more of an example, maybe even than the success on a mark in school. Because the child giving you respect,
yeah,
your concern is that the child develop respect so that he can, so A, of course, he can be in line with the, you know, what the Torah says to
right.
do, and B, so that he can develop his relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. Because if he can't learn to respect you, it's much more difficult for him to respect, have a relationship.
Even
with
the point you're making, even at a secular level, if someone else gives me respect, someone else tells me you're a great guy, so it boosts my ego. It basically, you know, it feeds my ego. That's the nice part of it. It's like, yeah, he thinks that
but
I'm great.
But you don't need it.
Well, a stranger, when a stranger shows me some respect or admiration, so it feeds into my self-esteem. When my child says, "Dad, really, that help was tremendous," it touches a very different nerve. It touches what I want is to be close to the child.
Right.
And if the child felt, so here you have that distinction where for an outsider, it feeds an external part of myself, and a child, it feeds the relationship.
Right.
I like it when my child tells me that I helped him because, not because I became greater in my eyes, but because I like that we have this. Yes.
So when Hashem says, if you're bekeri with me, I will be bekeri with you. Right. So there's always this concept of, I think this is really the dynamic tension between these two concepts of relationship
yeah.
with Hashem.
Right.
And non-relationship.
Correct. That's the only...
That's really ultimately the dynamic tension of those two concepts.
You can either engage or disengage. Like you can be neutral or you can be engaged. Correct. That's the...
But when we talk about God not being affected...
Right.
That does not bring us to a place of relationship. If I say to my child, you know, I'm just unaffected by what you do or what you think destroy relationships.
Well, unaffected in the sense it does not... If you got a 40 on the test, I didn't lose any money out of it. I didn't lose anything out of it. But the relationship has become this. When we sin, we don't harm God as such. But God wants a relationship and we harm the relationship. So that's where we've done harm. Okay, it's my time. 2 weeks from now is fine. Yeah, it'll be after Hanukkah, 2 weeks from now. It'll be Tuesday.